Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Nick. I'm your host tonight, and this is Circus Maximus. And I am echoing a lot. God, it's gone. Yes, thank you. April 21st, 2017. Yesterday was Uncle Adolf's birthday. And if you had some smoke, I'm sure you were smoking up a storm. I know I was. So welcome, everybody. It's Friday night. I hope you are enjoying your evening and hopefully the rest of this weekend. I know that there are a lot of things happening. There are drills going on that people should be aware of. I know that people in the research community are talking about something called Operation Gotham Shield, which has been planned for a while, but now that it's just a few days away, people in the New York and New Jersey area should be aware of the military drills going on in that region, in the Northeast region. A lot of websites covering this, so let's tackle it. I wasn't one that jumped on the Jade Helm bandwagon. I felt that that was a psyop or fear porn and whatnot. Nothing really ever came out of it, but we do know that drills did take place like they normally do. But with this one, this seems a little suspicious, just with the timing, the dates, the concept of what it's about, and we'll get more into it. So what is this? The shit hits the fan plan.com. SHTFplan.com. Operation Gotham Shield, U.S. government to simulate nuke blast over Manhattan as actual war nears. False flag watch is now active. A general alert is out for something major in the near or immediate future. Hopefully it is just another false alarm instead of another false flag. Either way, danger is at hand. Given all that is going on in the world, it is downright eerie to discover that the federal government is once again staging mock disasters that draw disturbing parallels with current world events. In just a few days, during April 24th through the 26th, Operation Gotham Shield will commence. It is a tabletop joint agency exercise involving FEMA, Homeland Security, and a myriad of law enforcement and military agencies. WMD, chemical and biological units will be on hand as a response is tested for a simulated nuclear detonation over the United States' foremost urban center in the iconic and densely populated island of Manhattan and nearby shores of New Jersey. The potential for a more explosive false flag to spin out of control by hijacking and converting the simulated actions is all too real. This is closely related to the mechanism that many researchers believe was at work on the day of 9/11, nesting a false flag attack inside of a series of large-scale training operations which invoked emergency powers and simulated attacks in locations that were actually hit. And on According to Voice of Reason, on April 18th through May 5th, 2017, state, local, and federal organizations alike are planning for Operation Gotham Shield 2017. A major nuclear detonation drill in the New York City, New Jersey area, along with the U.S.-Canadian border. During the exercise, four nuclear devices, two of which are rendered safe during the U.S. Department of Defense Vital Archer exercise, and one successful 10-kiloton detonation in the New York City area, along with one smaller detonation on the U.S.-Canadian border, are to take place. Among the organizations, Department of Energy, Department of Defense, Domestic Nuclear Detection Office, Federal Bureau of Investigation, FEMA, Northern Command, NORTHCOM, State of New Jersey Office of Emergency Management, New York Office, City of New York Emergency Management. The following document comes from the Nevada National Security Service. Their primary role with the government is to help ensure the security of the United States and its allies by supporting the stewardship of the nuclear deterrent, providing emergency response capable and training, and contributing to key non-proliferation and arms control initiatives. So what does Snopes have to say? Jew-controlled Snopes. What is Operation Gotham Shield? Operation Gotham Shield led to predictable uptick in false flag and nuclear apocalypse rumors, but the long-planned preparedness training was neither secret nor suspicious. 2017, a disaster preparedness drill called Operation Gotham Shield became a topic of interest on conspiracy sites and web forums, prompting speculation that the intriguingly named event was either a planned false flag attack, or a hastily assembled cover for an anticipated nuclear strike on the United States of North Korea. Peaked conspiracy buffs flocked to the websites and social media pages for small regional healthcare agencies and disaster preparedness organizations in order to voice their concerns. Readers seemed to have little understanding of what the exercise might encompass, but were still reasonably certain people should either be vigilant or else leave town. One popular version of the theory flagged the operation as a false flag or ongoing cover-up and insinuated that the drill would lead to genuine disaster. A joint operation codenamed Gotham Shield is scheduled for April 24th and 25th. The premise of the simulated crisis will be the detonation of a 10,000-ton nuclear device in the air over New Jersey. The EMP pulse caused by the detonation of this device will cause the disabling of most telephone, internet, and other electronic devices in a 20-kilometer radius around the detonation site. The problem with this exercise is that many times in the past, federal exercises have become actual events. So that's Snopes. I can keep going on and on, but they're calling this fake news and the Jade Home conspiracy tards, basically. Well, Kyle's got a clip that is really strange that occurred in September of last year, right around when the election was taking place, right before that. And it was broadcasted on the emergency broadcasting, tie-ins to AM radio. Well, they'll just jump in and cut off whatever broadcast was going on at the time. So, Kyle, let's hear this clip.
Donald Trump. Flag slide. Code 0001. Drop now. Trump, April 26. Drop code black. C75193801001001. Trump will go 26th. Drop April 26th. Donald Trump to be out. Black flag slide. Code 0001. Drop now. Trump, April 26. Drop code black. C75193801001001. Trump will go 26th. Trump, April 26th. Donald Trump to be out. Black flag slide. Code 0001. Drop now. Trump, April 26. Drop code black. C75193801001001. Trump will go 26th. Trump, April 26th. Donald Trump to be out. Black flag slide. Code 0001. 26, drop code black C7519380101001. Drop will go 26, drop April 26th.
That's weird. That is weird. So that was in Iowa. Person woke up to that with their alarm clock playing, and that was the AM broadcast in Iowa. Other people reported in the New Jersey, New York area hearing the same exact thing while they were driving. So April 26th, Trump. What does that mean? Well, we're right around the corner. We're going to find out, I guess, right? Another interesting tidbit is Melania, Trump's wife, Melania, that's her birthday too. So it could be a big day. It was a big day last year for Trump. He ended up killing it at the different debates against the other Republican people who were running for the race. And he killed it that day. But this was in September, so it wasn't April 26th last year. So this is future tense. What does it mean? I don't know. We'll find out. Pretty freaky, though. So just on the East Coast, just be a little bit prepared. We had some major blackouts occur in New York today, as well as San Francisco and L.A. San Francisco seemed to have gotten the brunt of it, and they were down for several hours. 90,000 people without power in the Silicon Valley region. So that was interesting. So what's going on? We've also got a meeting happening in New Zealand right now, this weekend, with the Crown Corporation countries, Australia, Britain, Canada, America. They're having a private meeting over in New Zealand and wondering what's going on with that. And we've got a supermoon happening on April 26th as well. And it's also the Day of Remembrance for Chernobyl. So we've got an interesting date. I looked at the history of events that have occurred throughout history on April 26th. Seems like a day of a lot of devastation. Nuclear testing, a lot of nuclear testing took place on April 26th, as well as tornadoes, hurricanes, and earthquakes. So it's a day of devastation from what I've gathered throughout the past couple hundred years. Of course, they weren't testing nukes 200 years ago, but the hurricanes, tornadoes, and earthquakes. So something to be on our toes about, unfortunately, but we should always be on our toes. I do have a caller from Las Vegas. Want to see what the caller would like to have to say here. Go ahead. I'm going to unmute you. Go ahead, caller. Welcome to the show.
Just listening. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. So, and then I saw an article from Zero Hedge that China is predicting that April 25th will be the date that North Korea is planning a large-scale nuke test. So, nuke. I don't know. I mean, are nukes real? Is this fear porn? Is there really a nuclear apocalypse around the corner? I don't know. I just can't see why they would just destroy the entire planet all at once. They would have to have some sort of escape route. Where do they go? Underground? With all the fallout? Do they go to Mars? Are they ready to go to Mars yet? Do they have teleporters? Who knows? Right now, Venezuela is heating up like what was predicted on the show when I had Jonathan Azizai on, that Rex Tillerson and the neoliberals would be going after Venezuela and their oil. And we're seeing the neoliberals feeding the frenzy and getting the so-called right wing of the Venezuelans all fired up, and there's protests, people dying. People have been killed at these protests. A lot of people are angry, but the soldiers, the military, will stand behind Maduro. It's going to be very difficult to have a coup d'etat when you've got the military backing the leader of your nation. Well, all it takes is one person, really. We know that from the Julius Caesar story and Brutus and whatnot. And all it takes is one of your close allies, who you think is your close ally, stab you in the back. I would say that that would be the only way to completely overthrow Maduro. I know that those type of plans have been being discussed as far as assassination attempts with the North Korea leader, because same situation, if you don't have the, if you have the military backing the leader, it's very tough to do a coup d'etat, especially on someone else's soil. That's why proxy armies have been so prevalent past decades. And the coup d'etat of Chavez, that didn't work out too well either for America and then IMF and the neoliberals over there either, because he had the military backing him. He was in custody, but the military acted it out and played it off, and then basically here's Chavez marching down the street with the military and all of his people. So I don't know what's going to happen with Venezuela, but we know that the pressure's increasing. They could definitely have some sort of an assassination squad to take them out. We had a convenient attack in Paris that we're kind of like Trump 2.0 going through the campaign and the different operations that took place on American soil or even in European nations, where you could tell that these operations, these Gladio staged operations, actually benefited Trump. And we're seeing the same thing happening with Le Pen with these recent, with this recent Paris attack. And the election is happening very soon. I think it's next week, if I could be mistaken. I don't know. Sometimes I just feel like just going and living my life and not even focusing in on any of this information. There's no reward in doing so except trying to wake up people and trying to help people prepare and be aware of controlled opposition. Yes, Kyle, please join me.
Hey, Nick. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Not many people out there come even close. So you're doing us all a great service. I want to just add in one more thing to the mix here. It ties into the power outages. And that's this article that just came out. It was linked up on the Drudge Report, coming from the Sun, talking about solar flares that could be hitting, actually, right around when my solar storm will be on Sunday with Christopher John Bjerknes. So they're saying it could cause havoc, blackouts. They've had these kinds of stories now for at least a few years. They've been talking about this for a long while. But when you tie this all in together with Operation Talpiot, which you know very well about, with you having done that show with Brendan O'Connell, and this is something that he's talking about a lot now, which is the Israeli ability to essentially shut down and own our energy infrastructure. So they could very well blame, say, an attack on, you know, on the Sun. They could blame it on North Korea. They could blame it on all sorts of different people. But I think we'd know who would be to blame or who to thank if our power goes out. So people should really not necessarily get too worked up about all the fear propaganda, but definitely look into the different narratives that are being put out with the awareness of the of our enemy's capabilities to really inflict massive chaos upon us. So that's all I really wanted to add. Thanks, Nick.
Hey, thanks. I agree. And NASA just put out that similar type of article talking about solar storms and the ways that they're trying to overcome them and how they affect the electrical grid. And they got into the nitty gritty, like the scientific terms, a little bit more outside of the layman terms of what actually occurs with these solar flares. So, yeah, I agree that it's noteworthy to pay attention to the different narratives that could be utilized for a pending downing of our power grid. And that's been at the forefront of our putting that in our minds, that the power grid could be hijacked and hacked. And which to me, it doesn't make sense how a power grid could be hacked if, since the power grid is not on the World Wide Web, it would have to be, to me, in my opinion, it would have to be more of like that Stuxnet situation where the virus or whatnot is fed into like a USB zip stick, zip drive, putting the data into the mainframe and computer components to have as a virus to do whatever it needs to do to cause a nuclear meltdown or whatnot. But it's not like our power grids and our nuclear power plants are on the World Wide Web. They have their own intranet. So it'd have to be some sort of inside sabotage, I would think, to put that virus into the power grid. I don't know if Kyle wants to add on that because he's more into the IT, but I don't think you could hack into the power grid because it would be just not, it wouldn't make sense to put your power grid on the World Wide Web for anyone to have access to that and taking the chances of hackers to actually hack into it.
What was the film that came out, something about Armageddon, that Alex Jones was promoting last year? Do you remember what I'm talking about? It was some wealthy guy, I guess he opened a bunch of gyms, of I think women's gyms, and he put out this movie that Alex Jones was promoting about the power grids going down. I think it starred Chuck Norris's son.
Was it the gray state where this person automatically disappeared and everyone's like freaking out, like, oh, he got suicided?
Apparently that person and the official story, the guy who did the gray state, his family was supposedly murdered by him. So the conspiracy is that they just murdered them all, which was very unsettling as I was about to release Hellstorm at that time. But that wasn't even a groundbreaking documentary, to be honest. It was pretty much kosher conspiracy all the way. Let me just try to find the name of that film there. But it ties in completely. I don't know the technicalities of how the energy grid is really set up. It would make sense that it would be communicating very much using internet technologies. I don't know what kind of... I don't think that they probably have dedicated enough resources to actually protecting our energy grid from hack attacks, but there probably would be ways to get in there. If it's Armageddon, that's the film name.
Okay.
This is one thing. If people want to search Armageddon InfoWars, it was a pretty big promotion last year. Well, actually going back to 2015, where Alex Jones was promoting this idea that you know, the elite will take down our power grid. They very well could.
Agreed. Yeah, so off on another tangent here. We've got U.S. Defense Secretary Mattis over in Israel right now. And we also have Sean Hannity broadcasting live his Fox News from Israel. I guess he's interviewing, or he has interviewed Netanyahu this evening. So Greg McCarron will be calling in later to provide his analysis of that interview of Hannity and Netanyahu. I'm looking forward to that. But here, Netanyahu welcomes Trump's strategic change of U.S. foreign policy. This was dated today. U.S. Defense Secretary Mattis, if good people don't band together, then bad people can do a lot of damage. Israel and many countries in the region and the world welcome the strategic change in the American foreign policy ushered in by U.S. President Donald Trump, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Friday. Netanyahu, speaking in his office before a meeting with visiting U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis, said that Israel senses a great change in the direction of American policy. He said that this has been made clear by Mattis, clear and forthright words about Iran, which follows very strong and forthright words on the part of President Trump and very forthright deeds against the use of chemical weapons by Iran's proxy, Syria. This change, Netanyahu said, has been appreciated around the world and in our region. I think this is a welcome change, a strategic change of American leadership and American policy. The Prime Minister said that Israel and the U.S. share common values and also common dangers. He said the common dangers are the twin threats of militant Islam, embodied in the Shia extremists led by Iran and the Sunni extremists led by Islamic State. And wasn't it over 100 people that were killed and injured that were Shias with the extraction of civilians in Syria just last week, who were just regular old people trying to escape a war zone, and then U.S.'s proxy armies had a suicide bomber and blew up a bunch of people. And they were Shias, from what I understand. Netanyahu said that the two countries are committed to thwarting the dangers and seizing the common opportunities that have emerged thanks to a commonality of interests with some of Israel's Arab neighbors. Mattis, on his first visit as Secretary of Defense, responded to Netanyahu, "I think it's important that we remind ourselves that if good people don't band together, then bad people can do a lot of damage in this world." I already read that. "And we're committed to stopping that and doing whatever it takes to pass on peace and freedom to the next generation." Yeah, those are the two people that I really feel confident that we're going to pass peace and freedom to the next generation. I put all my weight in that. I was watching this video, and he was reading a book, and it was from Benjamin Disraeli, who I understand was the first British prime minister who was Jewish, who was known as a Jew. And the book is... we'll be right back at the break.
One side of World War II. They don't want us to know the real history of what happened over 70 years ago, seeing through the eyes of the German victims. The horror of the terror bombing, the mass rape of millions of women and children, the torture and murder of civilians, the death camps for surrendered soldiers, the ethnic cleansing of whole countries, and the planned extermination of the entirety of the German people. After watching Hellstorm, you'll never see the good war and the good guys in the same light ever again. Watch for free and get DVDs at hellstormdocumentary.com.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, You hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend.
Welcome back to Circus Maximus. I'm your host, Nick Spiro. I do have another call. We've got a Chicago number. Welcome, Chicago.
Hey, Nick. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, Ed?
Ed on the south side.
Yes, I know your number, and I know your voice, Ed. How you doing?
Good, brother. How are you?
Man, just really, frustrated with all the shit going on in our world. I've got kids. I've got a grandson. I just can't fucking take this shit, man. I'm pissed.
I know. I heard you. I heard you, and that's why I'm calling. Jesus Christ, I feel your pain. I got a 30-year-old son, nutcase. And guess what? Little kids, little problems. Big kids, big problems. You know what I mean? But anyway, that's another side story. But, Nick, hang in there, brother. We're with you. I'm with you. You know, I'm seriously, physically, I'll be with you if you know, we ain't that far apart, you know. But anyway, brother, hang in there, man. I heard you, and you sounded a little down. And that's why I'm calling.
I just want to say
that I support you 100% and more than words, all right?
Thank you. All right, Ed. Did you want to hang on and listen, or?
Yeah, I'll hang on and listen, brother.
All right, appreciate it. All right. So, we're going to get into... Well, I'm going to read this real quick out of the Benjamin Disraeli book, Coningsby or the New Generation. And it's just real quick, and it kind of ties into, is it the Jesuits? Is it the Jews? Or is it both? Well, let me do that quick Jesuit find here, and here we go. Here's a quote. You never observe a great intellectual movement in Europe in which the Jews do not greatly participate. The first Jesuits were Jews. That mysterious Russian diplomacy which so alarms Western Europe is organized and principally carried on by Jews. That mightily revolution which is at this moment preparing in Germany, and which will in fact a second and greater reformation, and of which so little is as yet known in England, is entirely developing under the auspices of Jews, who almost monopolize the professorial chairs of Germany. Neander, the founder of spiritual Christianity, and who is Regius Professor of Divinity in the University of Berlin, is a Jew. Benari, equally famous and in the same university, is a Jew. Well, the Arabic professor of Heidelberg is a Jew. Years ago, when I was in Palestine, I met a German student who was accumulating materials for the history of Christianity and studying the genius of the place, a modest and learned man. It was Weil, then unknown, since become the first Arabic scholar of the day and the author of The Life of Muhammad. But for the German professors of this race, their name is Legion. I think there are more than 10 at Berlin alone. So this basically just talks about Jewish hiding their power in plain sight, people not even realizing that they are Jews. And this guy talking with another person about, hey, relax, we're slowly, incrementally taking over the ranks as time goes on. So a book worth reading, and it's also an audio form on YouTube. And I heard another call in. Looks like Ed hung up. So, all right. All right. I know that John, who's in the chat room, I'm not sure if he's in there now, he put together a video. Him and I have been talking on the side about the Mercers and Cambridge Analytica. And, he brought an NGO that I was already familiar with, the Gatestone Institute. And we're going to dig into that because the Gatestone Institute is a think tank where you see a lot of the controlled media, the alt-right, your Pamela Gellers, Robert Spencers, these type of publications that come out, your Geert Wilders, who are all talking about the radical Islam, but then they're slowly, incrementally transforming Western society into kosher nationalism, civic nationalism, philo-Semitism. And that's the objective of this think tank. And let's get into it. Gatestone Institute. Here's a... Well, I'm not going to read that quote because they're hijacking John Adams. Gatestone Institute, a nonpartisan, non-for-profit international policy council and think tank, is dedicated to educating the public about what the mainstream media fails to report in promoting. Institutions of democracy and the rule of law, human rights, a free and strong economy, a military capable of ensuring peace at home and in the free world, energy independence, ensuring the public stay informed of threats to our individual liberty, sovereignty, and free speech. Hey, it sounds great, doesn't it? Wow, who wouldn't want to support an organization like that? You know, that's how they do it. Gatestone Institute conducts national and international conferences, briefings, and events for its members and others, with world leaders, journalists, and experts analyzing, strategizing, and keeping them informed on current issues, and where possible, recommending solutions. Gatestone Institute will be publishing books and continues to publish an online daily report that features topics such as military and diplomatic threats to the United States and our allies, events in the Middle East, and their possible consequences, and the transparency and accountability of international organizations. Gatestone Institute is funded by private donors and foundations. We are grateful for your support. The ambassador, John Bolton, and the president, Nina Rosenwald. We're going to get into her. Naomi H. Perlman, vice president, Board of Governors Information. The Viscountess Burstead. Baroness Caroline Cox. Alan Dershowitz, the Lord Finkelstein, OBE, Jack Fowler, Robert Emmerman, Lawrence Kadish, Rebecca Mercer, Engelbord Rennert, Rebecca Sugar, Merrill Tisch, Amir Tahiri, Chairman, European Board of Governors, Board of Governors, Gatestone Europe, Chairman Amir Tahiri, Anne Elizabeth Maltet, Board of Advisors Information, Ahmad Chari, Reverend Dr. Petra Helt, Zudi Zasser, Richard Kemp, Michael Mukasey, and guess what other name is on here? Eli Weasel. And a big name who I've talked about, who happens to belong to the second most think tanks in the world, besides Kissinger, James Woolsey. So those are some of your big names there, board of directors and ambassadors and whatnot. So you've got some of your other people like Geert Wilders who belong to this. So let's get to the email that John sent me, which covers some good information. So here he goes. Nick, I hope all is well. Da, 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 da. Gatestone Institute is described as a right-wing think tank, which it's nonpartisan if you think about it, because it's got Dershowitz there, right? A lot of these people were former Democrats anyway, including Nina Rosenwald. All right. So, well, I found out that the Mercer Family Foundation is a donor to the Institute. Many other Zionists also have donated to them. And then he sent me their tax form, Schedule B, showing their donations. And, of course, they're not going to show all of them. On the screen capture from April 9th shows Rebecca Mercer's name on the Gatestone Institute's list. Looks like it did get scrubbed. He had to do a web, like a Wayback Machine or whatever. All right, so Gatestone was founded by Nina Rosenwelt, heiress to Sears, Roebuck & Company. She is described as an ardent Zionist and serves as president. Rosenwelt was originally a Democrat and supported Democratic groups. Rosenwelt has served on the board of AIPAC, the central arm of America's Israeli lobby, and holds leadership roles in a host of mainstream pro-Israel organizations. As groups like AIPAC lead the charge for a U.S. military strike on the Islamic Republic of Iran, threatening to turn apocalyptic visions of civilizational warfare into catastrophic reality, Rosenwald's wealth has fueled a rapidly emerging alliance between the pro-Israel mainstream and the Islamophobic fringe. Rosenwald's donations to pro-Israel organizations have earned her a place of considerable influence in the pro-Israel firmament. She has also served on the board of directors of pro-Israel organizations Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and was vice president of Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, also known as JINSA. You guys should look into JINSA. In 2003, she was a recipient of the Louis Brandeis Award given by the Zionist Organization of America for her pro-Israel advocacy. She also serves on the board of Human Rights in China, the Middle East Forum, the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting. Times of Israel co-founder Seth Claren donated $1.5 million in 2012. There's an article there from Haaretz. The National Committee on American Foreign Policy, the Institute for National Security Studies in Israel, and the American Friends of the Open University of Israel, which raises funds to expand access to higher education for all Israelis. In 2003 alone, the Rosenwald Family Fund donated well over half of its $1.6 million in total contributions to pro-Israel and Islamophobic organizations. The alliance serves to sanitize and legitimize professional anti-Muslim bigots like Wilders, allowing their ideas to mingle easily with those of neoconservative foreign policy heavyweights intent on promoting the appearance of convergence between U.S. and Israeli interests by invoking the specter of common Islamo-fascist enemy. In 2007, the Washington Post listed Rosenwald as one of the people of means and influence who raised money to lobby President Bush to pardon Scooter Libby. It's interesting why Rosenwald was so interested in getting a corrupted Zionist advisor to Dick Cheney to be pardoned for his involvement in Iran-Contra. Here he says, this is what John's saying, Josh Reeves has covered other CNP-connected groups and people with their involvement with Iran-Contra, and he says he's sure it's worth looking into depth. Yeah, the thing with Josh Reeves is he was great on CNP in some ways, but then he poo-poos the importance of the Jewish factor. He is claiming ties to the Fabian Society and a eugenics organization in Scotland and the Knights of Malta and the Vatican and things of that nature, which there are ties to all of those things that I just said. But he avoids the Jewish topic, and he doesn't even tie in the top, a lot of the top people from PNAC being CNP members as well. So that's why it's important to not just stick with one researcher and call him your guru and just go along and get along and rely on that one source of information. When somebody puts out good information, you're supposed to expand upon that. You're supposed to take it, take what bits and pieces are relevant, because a lot of people put fluff into their documentaries just for the time. At the same time, it's important to just keep going on and finding the dots and connecting them even further, and not avoiding certain issues that make you feel uncomfortable, and worrying about your listener base as far as, are they going to be bothered that I'm constantly talking about the Jewish problem? No, fuck that. Talk about it. Talk about all of the different aspects of this global conspiracy of trying to control the world and pretty much impoverish everybody besides them. So, all right, here we go. The chairman of Gatestone Institute is John Bolton. Robert Mercer heavily donated to John Bolton's Super PAC that distribute campaign financing to candidates that agree with his national and foreign policies and negative campaigns against those who do not. He is a Breitbart regular, which Mercer is or was part owner. One of Bolton's latest visits on a radio show on Breitbart, he was voicing his concerns over the U.S. embassy not moving to Jerusalem fast enough for his liking, and U.S. pushing back on Israeli settlements. Huh. Well, he must not know about Trump donating money to American Friends of Beit El, a charity that is building Israeli settlements. Oh, I'm going to pull up that article real quick. Trump donated $10,000 to Beit El settlement, which isn't a whole lot. It was recent, though. It was just a few months ago. Trump gave the donation years ago in honor of David Friedman, his choice of ambassador to Israel, former MK says. Oh, that's fine. $10,000, that's... Oh, actually, he only gave $1,000, I think, to Scientology for some sort of cure for the 9/11 responders, first responders. Not much of a donator from what I can tell. But anyways, so here's that. All right, there are even more connections. There is Gorka, who I've brought up, Sebastian Gorka, and also Greg McCarron. I fed him some interviews that Gorka did, and he talked about it with Jeremy a couple weeks ago. So... I think it's very important for people to understand the geopolitics of what's going on. Listen to the interviews of these people that are in the Trump cabinet, like Gorka. These Breitbart actors are actually doing interviews with people from the Trump cabinet. So listen to those. Gorka is a really interesting character that people should pay attention to. So, Gorkas that you brought up to my attention last week have both been contributing writers on Gatestone Institute's site. All the writings have a anti-Muslim focus. The articles you sent me from the Jew-infested Forward was trying to link Gorka to a Hungarian national group and failed to mention his ties to Zionist billionaires. I also want to mention a couple other writers for the Institute that are also authors at Breitbart. David Horowitz, who describes himself as an ex-Marxist, is an author of this Jew propaganda book touted by Alex Jones called The Unholy Alliance, about the lefties' alliance with radical Islam. Excuse me. He has also been on Alex Jones regularly, promoting his book in the past months. Another is Robert Spencer, who looks like a Jew. Yes, I would say yes. And he works for Horowitz as his Jihad Watch, which he is the director, is part of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And then you could read more about Robert Spencer at jihadwatch.com. You could find a list of all the columnists here at the Gatestone Institute. There is also a link to Amatech. They donated stock to Gatestone, as shown in the same link where the Mercer donation is listed. Yeah, I noticed that. I don't know much about them, but I'm sure they have major interest in funding such groups. Amatech.com, that's Ametek.com. Yes, the donation list in their tax return, it shows stocks as being... ways of donations occurring from Amatech. So there is a tie in there, and it's I did look it up, and it looks like a technology firm, but they are promoting diversity this, and it seems like another NWO Jew-controlled operation in the tech industry and some sort of other industries. All right, let's look at the columnists that are writing for the Gatestone Institute. Max Blumenthal reports, at the April event, Wilder's seamless fusion of anti-Muslim bombast and pro-Israel cant was gratefully received by the Gatestone Institute's founder and director, Nina Rosenwald, who he acknowledged at the top of his Jeremiad as another of his good friends. An heiress to the Sears Roebuck fortune, Rosenwald spreads her millions throughout the William Rosenwald Family Fund. She's actually a billionaire. A nonprofit foundation named to her father, a famed Jewish philanthropist. Yeah, sure. Who created the United Jewish Appeal in 1939. His daughter's focus is more explicitly political, according to a report by the Center for American Progress titled Fear, Inc. Rosenwald and her sister Elizabeth Verrett, who also directs the Family Foundation, have donated more than $2.8 million since 2000 to organizations that fan the flames of Islamophobia. A lot more than that. Besides funding a who's who of anti-Muslim outfits, Rosenwald has served on the board of AIPAC, the central arm of American's lobby, and holds leadership roles in a host of mainstream pro-Israel organizations. As groups like AIPAC lead the charge for a U.S. military strike on the Islamic Republic of Iran, this looks like it was already included. Okay, here we go. Senior staff of Gateway, columnists. I don't recognize any of these people. Douglas Feith? That's an interesting name that people should already know about. He's a contributing author over there. Well, this is from SourceWatch. Take a look at it. There's a lot of names that you'll recognize and a lot that you don't. Some are hyperlinked, some aren't, where you can find out who these people are. But it's a very powerful think tank that people should really focus in on. And here we go from SourceWatch, or Right Wing Web. The Institute, where'd it go? Gatestone is a clearinghouse for right-wing commentaries on national security, the Middle East, and Islam, as well as a convener of high-dollar events on security and energy issues. It is an offshoot of the neoconservative Hudson Institute. The Institute was founded in 2011 by Nina Rosenwald, an heiress of the Sears Roebuck Empire. Describing Gatestone's origins, journalist Max Blumenthal writes, through her affiliation through the Washington-based Hudson Institute, where Norman Podhertz is an adjunct fellow, Rosenwald established a branch of the think tank in New York City. Operating under the Hudson banner, Rosenwald brought the controversial anti-Muslim Dutch politician Geert Wilders to town in 2008 to warn against the Muslim plot to rule the world by the sword. Wilders' tirade during that visit against the Prophet Muhammad, whom he described as a warlord, a mass murderer, a pedophile, was stringent, even by the standards of the hawkish Hudson Institute. By 2011, Rosenwald separated Hudson, New York City, from Hudson National Branch, changing her organization's name to Gatestone Institute. Among its activities, the Institute holds what it calls briefing council events, which have included talks by Waleed Fares, Charles Krautheimer, Andrew McCarthy, Elliot Abrams, William Kristol, and a host of other well-known right-wingers and Gatestone principals. Among its past have been a presentation by Zudi Zasser and the Battle for the Soul of Islam, a talk by former CIA Director James Woolsey titled War on America, a presentation in which Geert Wilders called Islam a violent ideology that wants to impose Islamic Sharia law on the whole world. In a 2014 event featuring Woolsey, former General David Petraeus, right-wing videographer James O'Keefe was there, and a host of conservative activists extolling the virtues of fracking for natural gas and oil. A notice on Gateway's website, which has been since removed, described the events as an invitation-only, exclusively for our members with a minimum donation of $10,000 required for participation. Sounds like the same setup that the Council for National Policy has, to be honest. Gatestone's other activities include red carpet events for personalities like Wilders and policy briefings by sympathetic speakers. The Institute also has announced plans to publish books, but the bulk of the organization's day-to-day output consists of blog posts by Gatestone fellows and like-minded writers offering neoconservative commentary and on current events and alarmist dispatches about the spread of Islam. Frequent topics include Israeli security, purported Palestinian malfeasance, Iran's nuclear enrichment program, and the supposed threat of Sharia law in Europe and in North America. Commentaries. Many of Gatestone's commentaries offer standard neoconservative tropes urging a more forceful and aggressive U.S. foreign policy. An April 2014 offering from Elliot Abrams, for example, complained that the Obama administration's foreign policy really is the foreign policy of Belgium, negotiations, negotiations, negotiations. What is missing in this formulation? In one word, power, referring to President Barack Obama and his past affiliations with figures commonly vilified by his Republican critics, Abrams added, this is the man who learned foreign policy from Rashid Khalidi and William Ayers and Jeremiah Wright. The habits to be broken as the administration might see them are militarism, aggression, Cold War thinking, and an alleged effort to dominate the world, imperialism, or what many others might call patriotism. Other Gatestone posts have urged a second military intervention in Libya and invade against a diplomatic agreement over Iran's nuclear program. Gatestone contributors often espouse views associated with the far right. Posts by Gatestone writers have alleged an impending Islamic takeover in the United Kingdom, warned that France is on the verge of submitting to Islam, fretted that Islamic Sharia law could easily become a permanent reality in Spain and across the European continent, and accused the U.S. government of promoting Islam in the Czech Republic and other European countries. In a 2014 posting, Gatestone fellow Soren Kern quoted Geert Wilders' quip, seemingly approvingly, that the fewer Moroccans in the Netherlands, the better. Kern claimed that Dutch Moroccan criminals are known to be highly indifferent to sentence in Dutch prisons, concluding that it is only the threat of deportation more than any other measure that is likely to deter Moroccans from a crime of life. You know what? I mean, that's fine. I completely agree with... We don't mix with Muslim. It's a completely different culture.
A country of migrants. I'm Jewish. Some of my family came in the late 19th century. I'm Sephardi on my mother's side.
The Liberal Democrats will always stand up for a Britain that is open, tolerant and diverse. And in that spirit, I very much welcome the Jewish European Election Manifesto, calling for a strengthening of EU hate crime legislation. As a party, we wholeheartedly value the relationship we have with the Jewish community, both in Britain and internationally.
Filled with all I found.
Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
Back. Welcome. This is hour number two, Circus Maximus. I'm your host, Nick Spiro, and we've been covering the Gatestone Institute and its ties to, well, the Mercers. Well, I've been covering the Mercers for a little while here, and here's a article from Loeb Log, Foreign Policy. Rebecca Mercer joins board of anti-Muslim think tank. This was a recent article, April 13th. By Eli Clifton. Earlier this month, Rebecca Mercer, the daughter of billionaire Trump backer Robert Mercer, was listed as a member of the Board of Governors of the Gatestone Institute, a New York-based anti-Muslim organization that has long opposed the immigrations of Muslims to the West. They're bringing them in to the West, but then here's think tanks opposing the immigrations of Muslims to the West. So you see how that works. Gatestone promptly scrubbed its website of any mention of its board members after Loeb Log reached out to it on April 11th for comment. But an archived version of the website captured by archive.org on April 9th shows Mercer's name. A March 24th capture shows the list without her name, suggesting that she was added on the board at some point between March 24th and April 9th. Gatestone has served as a reliable source of anti-Muslim immigration hysteria. The Intercept's Lee Fang cataloged some of Gatestone's more outlandish claims in an article published in February, in which he profiled the group's president, Sears heiress Nina Rosenwald. Here's what Fang wrote. Gatestone Institute produces a regular drumbeat of articles and punditry. The Institute claimed that the Obama administration refugee policy exposes Americans to the jihad. People don't even know what the word jihad means. Muslim refugees in Western countries are depicted in Gatestone Institute posts as rapists and hosts of highly infectious diseases that threaten the health of the German people. Fang detailed how Gatestone senior fellow Salim Mansour attacked Barack Obama for coddling Muslims and praised Trump's campaign pledge to ban Muslim immigrants. Another blogger, Nani Darwish, wrote, "Citizens from Islamic nations should be allowed into the United States only when the war on Islamic terrorism is won and when Islamic governments prove to the world they have fundamentally changed." The Mercers must have liked what they were seeing from Gatestone. The family opened its pockets to support the Gatestone Institute over the past couple years. In 2014, the Mercer Family Foundation contributed $50,000. Gatestone donor roles acquired by Loeb Log, viewable here, show that the Mercer family doubled its funding level in 2015, contributing $100,000. Rebecca Mercer is known for her close involvements in projects funded by her family. An Atlantic profile of the Mercers published in January highlighted Rebecca's interest in the family's philanthropic activities. Rosie Gray wrote, "Whatever her actual beliefs, there's one thing upon which people who have worked with Rebecca Mercer agree. She has a keen understanding of politics and likes to be involved in the day-to-day running of projects she's involved in. Many donors like to play strategist, much to the annoyance of the actual strategies in their employ. But Mercer appears to be more successful at it than most." Gatestone did not respond to an inquiry about whether the Mercer support and Rebecca Mercer's role in the Board of Governors is connected to any new programs or initiatives at the organization. This isn't the first time that the Mercer family has aligned itself with fringe members of the right who advocate ethno-nationalism. White House chief strategist Stephen Bannon previously headed up Breitbart, of which the Mercer family were co-owners. The publication regularly published anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant articles under Bannon's leadership. When the controversial deputy assistant to the president, Sebastian Gorka, immigrated to the U.S. from Hungary, Gatestone published a series of articles by him as Sebastian L. V. Gorka, the initial V signifying his membership in the ultra-nationalist and historically anti-Semitic Hungarian order, Vitzi Rend. Bannon later hired Gorka as a national security editor at Breitbart. Praise for Trump and a track record of opposing Muslim immigration to the West suggests that Mercer found Rosenwald and her colleagues, who include Gatestone chairman and former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, as well as fellow board member and retired Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz, to be friendly to the Mercer family's blend of libertarian economic policies and social conservatism. Rebecca Mercer, who served on Trump's transition team, pushed unsuccessfully for Bolton to be named Secretary of State. On Wednesday, the New York Times reported, Mr. Bannon's main political patron, the financier Rebecca Mercer, the daughter of Robert Mercer, a major Trump donor, holed up in her office at Cambridge Analytica in New York, discussing possibilities. Wait, holed up in her office at Cambridge Analytica. Interesting. Discussing possibilities for Mr. Bannon, should he leave, according to two people briefed on the meeting. Although serving in no official capacity with the Trump campaign or the White House, Alan Dershowitz has emerged as an apologist for the administration and a willing advisor for Trump. Dershowitz publicly defended Trump's reference to a one-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, acknowledged speaking with Trump about the administration efforts to ban immigrants from the majority Muslim countries, and slammed the Anne Frank Center for its recent call for White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer to be fired for his backhanded praise of Adolf Hitler in comparison to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. How does Spicer say Bashar al-Assad? He says his name's so funny, it's hilarious. Spicer said that even Adolf Hitler didn't sink to using chemical weapons, apparently overlooking the use of poison gas to murder millions of Jews as well as Roma and others in concentration camps. Dershowitz said, I'm prepared to give a pass to Spicer, but he bashed Anne Frank Center Executive Director Stephen Goldstein as a total phony and described the Anne Frank Center as a minor institution, no credibility within the Jewish community. With Mercer funding and membership on the organization's board, the Gatestone Institute appears to be positioning itself as a hub for far-right anti-Muslim advocates and apologists for the Trump administration's missteps in Middle East diplomacy and Muslim discrimination and casual adoption of Holocaust denial rhetoric. All right. And here's a article about, well, from Alan Dershowitz, actually. And this is from Jerusalem Post, but they took it from the Gateway Institute. So Jerusalem Post is actually posting Gateway Institute articles. So there you go. What North Korea should teach us about Iran. A nuclear Iran would be far more dangerous to American interests than a nuclear North Korea. We failed to prevent North Korea from developing North Korea or nuclear weapons. As a result, other options to stop it from developing a delivery system capable of reaching U.S. shores are severely limited. The hard lesson from our failure to stop North Korea before they became a nuclear power is that we must stop Iran from ever developing or acquiring a nuclear arsenal. Nuclear Iran would be far more dangerous to America interests than a nuclear North Korea. So there's that article. I just wanted to point that out, that Alan Dershowitz being plugged into a so-called far-right think tank, and here's Dershowitz writing the same way that all the so-called right-wing think tanks write. And Greg posted this article, or he sent it to me. Not sure what to make of it. Iranian-American State Department official demoted after Breitbart questions loyalty to U.S. So a longtime State Department official has been removed from office and reassigned after her loyalty to Donald Trump was questioned by right-wing media outlets. So these outlets like Breitbart, they have their trolls, and they write their articles, and it's as if the Trump administration is taking a lot of their marching steps from the people from Breitbart. They didn't like this person, so Trump administration got rid of her. So that's the gist of that article. Now, here's an interesting connection to Brexit. Now, Theresa May is going to hold another referendum, another vote on Brexit in June. I think it's June 6th, 6-6. How convenient. And, well, the people already voted, right? Well, why are we voting again, right? So that's an interesting situation happening in England with Brexit. They're trying to solidify and get more votes to kind of put a bow on top and say, this is really what the people want, because the vote was so close. It was only a couple point percentage difference of the end result of who wanted to stay and who wanted to leave. But the UK column is putting out information that they feel that this is going to create more of a one-party system, more of a dictatorship in England, and so that they can become more of a new military power all over again. So what people think of Brexit as leaving the EU, and it's going to prevent immigration and all the kind of good stuff that they packaged it up as when they were campaigning on it and promoting it and pushing it, it's not going to be that grand prize that you are hoping for. So people who are pushing the Brexit vote and how good it is, well, just be aware. It's not going to be a good thing. So here's a watchdog to launch inquiry into misuse of data in politics. Investigation follows revelations of digital firms' involvement in Brexit. And this is from The Guardian. The UK's privacy watchdog is launching an inquiry into how voters' personal data is being captured and exploited in political campaigns, cited as a key factor in both the Brexit and Trump victories last year. The intervention by the Information Commissioner's Office follows revelations in last week's Observer that a technology company part-owned by a U.S. billionaire played a key role in the campaign to persuade Britons to vote to leave the European Union. It comes as privacy campaigners, lawyers, politicians, and technology experts express fears that electoral laws are not keeping up with the pace of technological change. We are conducting a wide assessment of the data protection risks arising from the use of data analytics, including for political purposes, and will be contacting a range of organizations, an ICO spokesperson said. We intend to publicize our findings later this year. The ICO spokeswoman confirmed that it had approached Cambridge Analytica over its apparent use of data following the story in The Observer. We have concerns about Cambridge Analytica's reported use of personal data, and we are in contact with the organization. The company, which has offices in London, New York, and Washington, uses data analysis to build up sophisticated profiles of individuals to predict how they might vote. Reportedly part-owned by U.S. billionaire Robert Mercer, it claims to have played an influential role in the U.S. election, using its data crunching ability to identify key swing voters. Data crunching, algorithms, data mining. Mercer is a friend of former UKIP leader Nigel Farage. Last week, Andy Wigmore, the communications director of the pro-Brexit campaign group Leave.eu, told The Observer they had been introduced to the company by the Mercer family. They were happy to help. he said, because Nigel is a good friend of the Mercers. And Mercer introduced them to us. He said, here's the company we think may be useful to us. What they were trying to do in the U.S. and what we are trying to do had massive parallels. We shared a lot of information. In February 2016, the company's chief executive, Alexander Nix, talked about how it helped to supercharge Leave EU's social media campaign by ensuring the right messages are getting to the right voters online. Spokesperson for Cambridge Analytica denied it played any role, either paid or unpaid, during the referendum campaign, something that would have to be declared to the Electoral Commission. But Green MP Caroline Lucas, who was campaigned for Remain, said, clearly there are questions to be answered about the Leave campaign's use of big data and the potentially huge in-kind donation by Cambridge Analytica. To have a foreign billionaire's fingerprints left all over such a seismic moment in British history is deeply concerning and requires urgent further investigation as to whether electoral law was broken. A 2015 presentation by one of Cambridge Analytica's analysts, until recently available on YouTube, explained how it had used Facebook likes as an input to machine learning models. In the U.S., companies are free to use third-party data without seeking consent. But Gavin Millar, QC of Matrix Chambers, said this was not the case in Europe. The position in law is exactly the same as when people would go canvassing from door to door, Millar said. They have to say who they are, and if you don't want to talk to them, you can shut the door in their face. That's the same principle behind the Data Protection Act. It's why if telephone canvassers ring you, they have to say the whole long speech. You have to identify yourself explicitly. The Cambridge Analytica spokesperson said, we do not use data from Facebook. We do not have access to Facebook likes. What you have sent us relates to a research project done in 2015 with an intern data scientist using an anonymous data set. The goal was to reproduce findings in the peer-reviewed literature. Its application for us is limited by the fact that we don't have Facebook likes covering the population. Only Facebook has those data. Facebook's spokesperson said, our investigation to date has not uncovered anything that suggests wrongdoing with respect to Cambridge Analytica's work on the Leave and Trump campaigns. The spokesperson for Cambridge Analytica said, we are in touch with the ICO and are happy to demonstrate that we are completely compliant with UK and EU data law. Second specialist profiling company is also under scrutiny for its work in the Brexit campaign. Canadian firm Aggregate IQ uses targeting marketing such as online advertising, social media to ensure that its clients' content reaches the right people. And then BuzzFeed recently revealed how Vote Leave gave $625,000 to a student, Darren Grimes, which he then used to hire Aggregate IQ to produce a targeted pro-Leave Facebook ad campaign, apparently with spectacular results. Dominic Cummings, the campaign director of Vote Leave, declared, without a doubt, the Vote Leave campaign owes a great deal of its success to the work of Aggregate IQ. We couldn't have done it without them. Dr. Simon Moores, visiting lecturer in the Applied Sciences and Computing Department at Canterbury Christ Church University and a technology ambassador under the Blair government, said the ICO's decision to shine a light on the use of big data in politics was timely. A rapid convergence in the data mining, algorithmic, and granular analytics capabilities of companies like Cambridge Analytica and Facebook is creating powerful, unregulated, and opaque intelligence platforms. In turn, these can have enormous influence to affect what we learn, how we feel, and how we vote. The algorithms they may produce are frequently hidden from scrutiny, and we see only the results of any insights they might choose to publish. So Cambridge Analytica involved in Brexit as well as the Trump campaign. And originally it was the Cruz campaign, and that got flipped over to Trump. The right voice just followed me. I don't really like that guy. All right. I wanted to get into a Black Cube, which I know that Brendan O'Connell brought up, and I have an article on that. Oh, where'd it go? Real quick, the founder of the White Helmets was James Le Mesurier, was awarded the Order of the British Empire just recently. So there you go there. I did post an article regarding the Opus Dei connections. People should look into the Opus Dei. And with the CIA, it's been stated that the CIA was modeled after the Jesuit order with their intelligence gathering. Opus Dei would be part of that apparatus as well. So where are we with the black cube? I wish I had that open. Anyways, I am taking callers, so if you feel like you want to add to the conversation, have something worthwhile to add, 747-999-6407. Yes, I almost forgot this one. As you all know, I've been pretty good about covering Roy Cohn. Well, here's a recent article about Roy Cohn, eavesdropping on Roy Cohn and Donald Trump. This was just written April 14th in the New Yorker. In early March, President Trump sent four tweets accusing his predecessor of wiretapping the phones in Trump Tower in the months before the 2016 election. The tweets were just the latest manifestation of Trump's preoccupation with eavesdropping and surveillance, one that can be traced back decades. During the mid-2000s, Trump kept the telephone console in his bedroom at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach that allowed him to listen in on phone calls between his employees and sometimes staff and guests. Trump denied this. In the mid-1980s, Trump allowed Tony Schwartz, his ghostwriter, to listen in on his private phone calls with bankers, lawyers, and developers as Schwartz wrote The Art of the Deal. Yes, that's right, Trump tards. Trump doesn't write books. He has never written a book. He has ghostwriters. So, how you like them apples? Trump's private conversations with his late mentor, the lawyer Roy Cohn, were eavesdropped on by Roy Cohn's longtime switchboard operator and courier, whose activities were later exposed. Cohn, who had been an aide to Senator Joe McCarthy in the 50s, was a political fixture and lawyer who represented New York power brokers from the Yankees owner George Steinbrenner to the mob boss Carlos Gambino. Carlo Gambino, Trump was one of his favorite clients before Cohn's death of AIDS-related complications in 1986. The two men talked up to five times a day and partied together at Studio 54 and other nightclubs. Oh, between the April 26th connection that I brought up, that was the date that Studio 54 opened up to in 1977. So there's another April 26th date besides Melania's birth date and a bunch of other stuff. So Roy was brutal, but he was a very loyal guy, Trump told the writer. He brutalized for you. And that's actually the name of an article I read before, too, I believe. Christine Seymour had recently graduated from Sarah Lawrence College when she started working at the back office of Cohn's office as a switchboard operator, connecting calls with clients including Nancy Reagan, Gloria Vanderbilt, and the mobsters Gambino and Tony Fett Salerno. She listened in to all of them, Susan Bell, Cohn's longtime secretary, recalled recently. Not at his directions, but he knew. A pretty brunette, Seymour was, according to her brothers, brash and funny, with a gossipy sense of humor. Cohn had his reasons for tolerating her behavior. She was very efficient, and he liked that about her. She would work any time, day or night. She was always at his beck and call. After Cohn died and his law firm dissolved, Seymour left the city and moved to Florida. She settled in Key Colony Beach, a sleepy town at the bottom of the Keys, where in the early 80s she started writing a book, Surviving Roy Cohn, based on her notes on the eavesdropping calls. It must have seemed an ideal moment for a project that promised to take the reader inside the townhouse of one of the most scandalous figures in recent New York history. 1993, James Woods, scumbag, was nominated for an Emmy for his portrayal of Roy Cohn. good chance that James Wood and Cohn probably knew each other. And then on the morning of May 5th, 1994, the New York Post ran a column by Cindy Adams with the headline, "Savvy Chris Spills the Beans on Roy Cohn." In her characteristically breezy manner, Adams wrote about Seymour's book project, listing the secrets she would expose, how a porno flick was filmed in the office and business was conducted while someone was being whipped, how Senator Joe McCarthy hid the fact that he was gay. Chris taped conversations she wrote. She kept the log, 3 spiral notebooks a day of transactions. Adams wrote that Seymour monitored every call in and out, knew everything, everyone, knew where all the bodies were buried. The story ricocheted throughout the city, and Cohn's former law partners and staffers received calls from several other anxious clients, worried that their secrets would be revealed. 5 months later, on October 20th, 1994, Seymour was driving her blue two-door Yugo. Yugo. Holy shit. On a highway in Florida at dusk when she collided head-on with a tractor-trailer and was instantly killed. She was 46, and the book was still unfinished. Seymour's collaborator on the book, an author and literary agent named Jeffrey Schmidt, was at home on Long Island when he got the call from Seymour's mother, Adele, who lived in nearby Shoreham. As you recalled recently, on hearing the news of Seymour's death, he panicked, took a box of the notebooks, and burned them. As for the recordings, none of Cohn's former employees can confirm that Christine made any. But Christine's brother, Brian, who had once worked as a crew member on Cohn's 80-foot yacht, the same yacht that he burned and got insurance money and found a dead body on, by the way, defiance, told me that when Christine moved to Florida, she had handed him 3 small reel-to-reel tapes that she claimed she had made. And we're going to hold off there and finish this up because we're hitting a break. And we'll be right back. Thank you, everybody. And we got 1.5 hours. Please call in for the final half hour if you'd like.
As Mrs. and Mr. America fret, they huddle around their TV set, they worry and they sweat. They're thinking I'm the enemy, the one they need to get, because their mind controllers tell them I'm a major threat. The talking heads, the daily press, they cultivate stupidity and harvest ignorance. They point a crooked finger and they're all unanimous by calling me extremist, cause I'm down on Zionists. So now I want to sing a new song. I want to be an extremist. I want to join a militia and wear camouflage. I want to be an extremist and run around and sing a rabble-rousing rebel song and sympathize with the skiddies who realize it was the who did the Germans wrong. I want to be an extremist. I want to get the job done.
We are taught almost nothing about South Africa in Western schools, other than that there was an evil apartheid government of white racists who oppressed everyone until the great Saint Nelson Mandela came along. Now you can learn the real history of exploration, conflict, concentration camps for the Boers, Jewish-funded black terrorism, Winnie Mandela and her necklacing, rampant murder and rape under the ANC, the so-called squatter camps, how the Rainbow Nation is a blueprint for what's to come for whites worldwide, and so much more. Between Heaven and Hell, The True Story of Whites in South Africa by Sinead McCarthy, free to watch at whitesouthafrica.com.
The gods have blessed our soil and blood. We carry it on through drought and flood. We build this land upon our graves. As fortune favors just the brave. Don't worry, child, don't you fear at all.
Welcome back for the final half hour. And I was just discussing the secretary that was eavesdropping on Roy Cohn's phone calls and how she died. Wasn't able to produce the book and tapes and whatnot, and we'll finish up. Just a real quick tidbit, the Westminster Bridge attack. Nicki Minaj filmed a video one day before with all the background sceneries of the downtown London and Westminster. So just a little coincidence there. You had to film crews there one day before. So coincidence, right? So here we go with the Roy Cohn article. And where are we? The tapes were recalled. Okay, so Defiance told me that when Christine moved to Florida, she had handed him three small reel-to-reel tapes that she claimed she had made. The tapes were, he recalled, in god-awful shape, spooled and unspooled and crinkled. He stored them in his mother's attic, where he later found them. In 2009, after she passed away, we just tossed them in the trash, he told me. In the spring of 1995, Schmidt told the syndicated columnist Liz Smith that some tapes still existed and would soon be the basis for a Broadway musical written by Seymour and Schmidt with music by Jeanette Cooper. How many more films and musicals do we need of Roy Cohn, you know? Nothing Sacred is really Seymour's story. Her eavesdropping is at the heart of the drama. The play kicks off with Cohn's voice, heard over the telephone wire, and on one of her first days, she tells a colleague that Cohn is on the phone with Nancy Reagan, adding, "Oh, I wish I could hear what they're saying," the office manager replies. "Go ahead and listen. Roy doesn't mind." Later, she adds, "Some of the most important conversations of the 20th century have come through the switchboard, and they're all on tape. One of the first songs include the line, 'This damn phone needs a chaperone. Someone who'll defend the fortress of a friend. In exchange, she'll learn things she would never know.'" After one stage reading of Nothing Sacred in the winter of 1997 at the DiCapo Opera Theater on the Upper East Side, Schmidt got caught up in other projects, he said, and the play was never produced. Schmidt still lives in Stony Brook on Long Island, where he runs NYC Creative Management, a literacy agency. Last September, we met at Strand one afternoon and then walked across the street for a cup of coffee. It was a warm afternoon, da-da-da-da-da-da. I want to hear about the good stuff here. 1981 invitation to a Ronald Reagan presidential inauguration party, the Constant Forum, to participate in an AIDS drug trial, a few faded photographs and dozens of notes, some of them stained, written in Seymour's hasty longhand. The notes contain lists of clients who called Cohn's office, including their personal phone numbers. Seymour's reminiscence of her experience working with Cohn included lunch orders for pepper sausage and mushroom pizza slices, and her descriptions of Cohn's conversations with Trump, Steinbrenner, Vanderbilt, Nancy Reagan, among others, and what appears to be direct quotes from some of these phone calls, although it's almost impossible to know how much of Seymour's account in the notebooks and scripts to be true. I don't want to get any more into this. I'm going to go to the Black Cube, a Mossad-style business intelligence company. Globes investigates the secret methods of the Israeli company that has become an international leader in business intelligence. Among the transcripts and the affidavits related to legal battle by Bank Polyolim, P-O-L-I, against the heirs of the late businessman Mahdi Zisser, there is one story that would fit neatly into a spy novel. The story can be found in the response filed by a Swiss Jewish attorney called Philippe Meyer to a motion filed by Bank Hapoalim in the bankruptcy proceedings of Zisser against Meyer and others to limit the latter use of assets of the estate. Meyer, who is in the process of immigrating to Israel, was a late Zisser's partner in several of his business ventures in Europe. Companies he owned guaranteed some of Zisser's debts. In his response to the court, Meyer claims that in February 2016, he received a call from a European attorney and long-standing acquaintance. The attorney suggested a meeting, and at the meeting, so Meyer stated, the attorney claimed that a Mossad representative had asked him to recommend Jews around the world who might assist and the organization's efforts. Meyer expressed interest, contacted the Mossad representative, and met with him in Israel. The representative, so Meyer claims, wished to learn details about him and his professional activities and stated that the organization occasionally needs people like him for the operations and finance, especially in transferring funds up to tens of millions of euros, so Meyer stated. Meyer answered that he didn't believe that he could be of assistance in view of the rules of compliance, but the representative allegedly was not discouraged and proposed setting up a second meeting with an expert from the organization who would explain matters. They agreed to remain in contact and speak the next time Meyer was in Israel, but there has been no trace of the representative since then. The story may sound larger than life, but not entirely beyond the realm of possibility. Business people around the world have been used by intelligence services, but Meyer's story does not end there. To the best of my knowledge, Meyer's response claims the representative is a former Mossad agent who was employed by a private investigation firm that conducted an investigation of Meyer on behalf of the petitioner, Bank Hapoalim. To the best of the undersigned's knowledge, the firm is Black Cube. Black Cube vehemently refutes this story, groundless allegations, they told Globe's G Magazine. The man in question is not any person who works for Black Cube, either in or outside Israel. It should also be stressed that neither the person in question nor any Black Cube employee ever impersonated a Mossad agent. Such a meeting, if it took place, had nothing to do with the firm. In any event, this is an opportunity to gain a glimpse into the operations of the firm, whose name has popped up from time to time in major lawsuits involving key financial personalities in Israel and sometimes overseas. A partial list: Nachi Dachner versus Mari Ben Moshe, Rami Levy versus Eled Revid, Alstom and Afcom versus the light rail electrification tender, and others. The list of its board members is impressive, including Professor Asher Tischler, Dean of the School of Business Administration of Tel Aviv University, Lieutenant Colonel Golan Malka, former VP of Marketing and Business at Nice Systems. Nice Systems, that was the same company that Rebecca Roth brought up from Unit 8200 that was involved with the World Trade Center attacks on 9/11, just to let you know. And a Brigadier General, Matty Lasham, recipient of the Israeli Defense Prize. The late Mayor Dagan, former Mossad director, served as the company's president until his death a year ago. The Old Boys Club of the IDF Military Intelligence. Black Cube was founded in 2011 by Dan Zarella, originally from Haifa, who served in an elite unit in the IDF intelligence, and Dr. Avi Yanis, both in their early 30s. The two met when they studied for their BA in management and economics at Technion. Zarella continued to graduate studies in business administration at Tel Aviv University. While Yanis completed his doctorate, he currently lives in London and handles the investigations in Europe. Based on his background in IDF intelligence, among other things, Zarella managed to attract some big names to the firms, especially the late Mayor Dagan. Pundits note that giving your name to a company for a fee is entirely conventional behavior, but sources close to Black Cube claim that the late Mayor Dagan was involved in Black Cube's business and advised the firm since its founding. He advised Black Cube on complex issues that required his extensive specialization. He met with Black Cube clients who benefited from his vast experience. The late Mayor Dagan also gave Black Cube the benefit of his worldwide connections. Later, after he became familiar with all aspects of the firm's operations and in view of the firm's high standards of professionalism, Mayor Dagan became the firm's honorary president. Black Cube's first significant client was a Jewish-British billionaire, Vincent Chenjuiz, who learned of the firm throughout a mutual acquaintance. Chenjuiz recounted the story in an interview to G's Chakur Samuha last October. According to Chenjuiz, dozens of investigators from the British Serious Fraud Office raided his house and his brother Robert's house in March 2011 and arrested them on suspicion of a complex deception that led to the collapse of Iceland's Kaupthing Bank, Both brothers were released the same day and immediately claimed that the information that led to their arrest was untrue. They hired the services of Black Cube and managed to prove their case. Subsequently, Robert also sued the SFO, Cap Thing, and the Grant Thornton accounting firm, whose materials were used as a foundation for the charges. He reached a settlement with the SFO, in which he received an apology and $3 million. Got a call here. Welcome to the show, California. I believe you're Sean.
Yeah, hey, Nick. Man, you know, it's like, it's almost like Jew overload. I mean, I don't even know what to do. I mean, it's like so many names and stuff, but what the fuck do we do about this, man? What do we do about it?
You know, with such a small population, man, I don't know why we just haven't taken them out yet, you know?
Well, obviously it's the educational aspect of it where the people just don't understand, you know?
Years of indoctrination, the Holocaust.
How do we get this through? I mean, I know we, none of us have the answer to this. We've all seen that look on people's faces when we try to tell them this stuff. And it's like, it's really so damn simple. It's all around them, you know? I mean, but what do we do? What do we do? What is the next step? Somebody tell us what to do, because I don't know. I'm confused.
I'm doing what I know I can do.
You guys are doing a great job. I mean, it's just that's the thing. I mean, you guys are educating, but we're educating our own people. And again, it's like, how do we project this out on a wide scale? I've almost thought about like going out in the middle of the night and just like painting shit on stuff. You know, just because like you almost have to be like a ninja, you know, to get this information out and not ruin your own life.
Hey, I would welcome the bombers, the people that spray paint and make murals on buildings and bridges. And...
Yeah, why don't we do that? Why don't we do that?
That would help.
It would help. And if you were driving under a bridge in the morning on your way to work, and all of a sudden you see this big, you know, and people did it for a while, like 9/11 was an inside job and all the rest, you know, like a big message saying, hey, you know, I mean, where's our fighters? Where are our battle, you know, hardened people that are willing to make a little sacrifice for the cause, you know? That's the question, you know? I mean, we used to be very strong, even though, I mean, people were pretty bold in our communities and stuff. So, I don't know. It's confusing right now because you wonder, because I want to be out there. I want to be proactive, but I don't want to charge the hill alone either. You know what I mean? It's tough. It's a tough decision to make.
Well, there's any little amount counts, you know. If you have 20% of our population just in America, you know, putting out propaganda and spray painting and putting stickers on street signs and, you know, doing whatever you can and holding up banners whenever you've got time off and above highways.
I made like 500 fuck the NWO stickers when I first got into this. It said F. You know, I designed it myself. It said F, big F, the NWO. And I just stuck them everywhere. And, you know, now it's, of course, it's become much more sophisticated. It's not that simple. But you know, that was at the time, that was what I felt like that might help a little bit. You know, not so much to wake people up, because it doesn't really wake people up, to say to people like us that you're not alone. There's other people that understand where you're coming from. You know,
I know when I woke up back in 2007, 10-year anniversary coming up on waking up. I started writing on the dollar bills, you know, and
Well, you know, that's all good stuff. I mean, it's all little things that chip away, you know, because people might be looking at these kind of things and they might be on the fence, and then they see it there, you know. I mean, that's how the mainstream wins us over, is they just keep repeating the same shit, you know. It's like, so, okay. If we could repeat our message over and over and over again, to where it gets into people's minds, then maybe we could do the same thing. I don't know. Yeah, well, I've tried my own ways.
Even on our own podcasts, people might say, well, I've already heard this before. Well, I think the repetition factor is important to keep drilling these points and hitting them home and just...
Well, you could always have new people tuning in. Well, this is something that, like, you know, when I've introduced people to Renegade, I have a roommate I brought into it and the rest, but when I introduce people to it, they don't understand a lot of the content that we're talking about is for people that already experienced in this, yes. You know? So it might sound kind of gnarly to them. It might seem a little extreme.
Yeah, they need to take their baby steps. Renegade is...
Right. They need to go back and do back to the original stuff and like kind of start over again and then get to where we're at. So think about it. This is content. It's not tailored for them.
No. They got to go through a crash course first, like MWO for Dummies or something like that.
Exactly. JWO, yeah, right, exactly. You got to start at the beginning or you won't understand. It just sounds extreme.
Yeah, and we sound like kooks if they just first start listening to a show like this.
That's why, you know, in a way, I mean, he sounds like kook himself, but, you know, Jones is actually... I think the psyop that he is actually backfired to a certain degree because, you know, almost all of us kind of woke up to Jones, you know.
I woke up to a Ron Paul video, and one thing led me to another, led me to Alex Jones. I consumed maybe about a month or two's worth of his shows and documentaries, and I was just, then I found Bill Cooper, and I'm like, what the hell?
He set you straight. Yeah, no, that was crazy. When you listen to Alex Jones Y2K, that pretty much it tells you all you need to know about Alex Jones. I mean, that's so over the top. It's ridiculous. And then you listen to Cooper warning about him.
Yeah.
And it pretty much...
Correct.
Yeah, it pretty much fixes you up as far as that goes.
Yeah, but a lot of the same people that said, oh, I'm done with Jones, got pulled right back in with the Trump campaign.
No, you know, I don't know. I mean, well, I don't know too many people personally that even understand anything. But, I mean, I don't know too many people pulled back in. I think that a lot of people were assigned to pull us back in.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
To it.
Surprisingly, Mark Glenn is doing the same thing to the Arab, you know, supporters of Palestine and Syria, the Arab world. Mark Glenn, the spokesperson for World Jewry, as far as exposing it, is basically telling his listeners, you know, you got to stay with Trump. You know, he stay loyal, and he put out a podcast, and he purposely prevented certain listeners from. Who subscribe and pay a monthly fee to him from getting that podcast because he didn't want to get the angry emails from his listeners and his friends because he's pushing Trump still. And these people are like, Mark, what the hell are you doing? You know, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. You'll never get angry emails in this line of work. No, it's all just love. You pretty much got to get pretty used to getting attacked and stuff. But the Arab thing again. I wonder now. I don't give a shit about Arabs. I don't care about any people or.
Sean, I can barely hear you.
Yeah, I was just saying. Can you hear me better?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't give a shit about the Arabs or whatever else. I'm not on their side. But the point is why don't they? More of them speak up against this whole 9/11, this terrorist aspect. I mean, to me, it seems like they should be like really touting, you know, all the research that's been done to pretty much prove that they have nothing to do with it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like to me, part of me wants to go down there and say, hey, what are you guys doing? Why don't you just like explain to people that there's no evidence you did any of this shit?
Well, the thing is I covered on my show more than once, is that the clean break, all these things were in motion, planned ahead of time. So what ended up happening to the Arab world is they got indoctrinated too with Al Jazeera, you know? It was the Qatari world.
Right,
family.
But come on, I mean, it's like, yeah, they did get indoctrinated, but, well, I guess it's in a way, it kind of mirrors the whole idea of the German people being
or
indoctrinated.
American, it don't matter.
Right, but the German people being indoctrinated that they killed 6 million Jews, it really, you know, really it comes down to, Nick, is you can convince people of anything. I mean, there is no limit to what you can convince people of. They're so, so malleable and gullible.
Well, yeah, that's completely
really
true.
Disturbing.
The problem with people in general, general nature of people, is that they believe, they have faith and trust in experts, so-called experts. If they see them on TV, they know what
and
they're talking
science
about.
Science and religion and government. I mean,
doctors.
These are the things, yeah, right. These are the things that make you beyond reproach. Titles make you beyond reproach.
And that's what happens when you first meet somebody. Hey, what's your name? How you do? What do you do for a living? You know, it's like your title, your status. That's like right in the front of the conversation. Like what you do for work is really important or something. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. Well, it's also, you know, in your name, doctor this or, you know, all the rest. I mean, a lawyer, whatever else, yeah. So you must be unimpeachable. What you say must be the final word because you are trained in that. And we've heard that too many times, you know, in our circles, where like I can't make the opinion that something is fake because I'm not trained in, let's say, people's reaction to something. You know, I'm not a clinical psychologist who can tell, you know, that somebody's not actually crying tears when they're sad, okay? But I've spent a lifetime watching people be sad. I've gone to funerals. I've done all this stuff. And, yeah, I know when people are sad, they produce tears and their eyes get red. So I am kind of an expert in it. Even if I haven't got a PhD in it, I consider myself an expert, you know? And that's where we've gotten now, to where if you don't have an official title, your senses no longer can be trusted, and that's kind of the sickness that we've gotten to at this point. You know, you can no longer be considered, your opinions are invalid because you don't have a PhD. And the most simplest of observations are no longer valid. And that's kind of where we've gotten.
There's a documentary that I just saw by Adam Curtis, I think it's called. Hypernormal.
Somebody put parentheses around that, but whatever. I don't, it doesn't mean anything to me. I'm just curious because I didn't know who that was. So go ahead.
Yeah, he makes documentary films. Hypernormalization, it just came out recently. And that's basically talking about what we're just talking about right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that's how the people are. What qualifies you? What qualifies you to say that? You know, it's like, because I've seen a lot of people cry and they produce tears. You know, or I saw planes go by when I was a kid and they didn't do what they do now. You know, that's what qualifies me. My own personal experience, you know, it qualifies me to say this or that, you know, and that's the thing. It's just, it's strange. We've gotten away from our own perception as being valid, you know, and, I don't know.
Well, Sean, we're about to close up pretty soon. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Nick, they're just a good show as always. I always enjoy your Friday, you know, Friday shows and stuff. And Renegade, I appreciate Renegade being around. Last of the listenable radio, in my opinion. So thank you very much.
Well, I hope you're getting something out of it, and I hope everybody else is getting something out of it. There's a lot of names I drop I'm not pronouncing them correctly, so just go to the articles and you can look into these people that I'm bringing up, especially this Black Cube. Learned about them through Brandon O'Connell. Again, I'm going to plug Operation Tulpiat and Unit 8200. Brendan, if you're listening, start talking about Unit 8200. You're bringing up all the other good stuff, but you don't ever bring up Unit 8200, a very important organization. They're behind the tech industry that you bring up all the time. Next week, I'm going to have Jonathan Azizaya on my show. We're going to touch upon the Venezuela issue and the Middle East and the Brexit, the France. I believe the French elections will be going on, and we'll be able to talk about that. What's up?
The Brexit? I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, Brexit is the next step that France would like to.
Well, I'd like to see the Brexit actually happen first. I knew that wouldn't happen anyway, but
I'd like to see it happen in the way that they packaged it up to be, but it's not going to be what they claim it's going to be. That's the downside. If you want to learn more about Brexit, check out the UK column. They do a show Monday through Friday in the mornings, and they talk about the child sex slave rings at the higher echelons of the elite in Westminster, and they talk about Brexit and a lot of the kinds of things that we talk about on this show, but more of a UK perspective. Other than that, yeah, Black Cube looks like an organization that people really need to look into. Other than that, we had some other false flags. I didn't really look into them. I think there was one in Seattle or California. We had, and then we had that girl that got kidnapped by her teacher who ended up getting found. We had another live stream Facebook murder, another PSYOP with live streaming violence. So I wonder what that whole, who benefits in that and why these things are happening. A lot more to discuss next week.
And also, he killed 15 people, but we only hear from one family.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, but we all forgive him. God bless the man.
Oh, yeah, right. But donate to us.
There's a couple GoFundMes for this one guy. All right, everybody, that's the show. I hope you enjoyed, and tune in tomorrow night for the roundtable. Good night, everybody.
Bye. No safety, no surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be?
How do you now see the future of the issue of immigration developing now across the whole of the European continent based on what you're seeing there in Germany?
This is a very good point, because immigration is the future. You cannot work and live in a globalized world, in the middle of the world, in Europe, without immigration.
So there's a second thing in that black box, an unrelenting stream of immigration, nonstop. Fewer than 50% of the people in America from then and on will be white European stock. That's not a bad thing. That's a source of our strength.